My name is John Wallace. I'm on the teaching staff this summer. I'm an economist. I'm talking about a small topic, how societies work this summer. Just a small piece of things. Actually, I want to change my title. I'm on the Holden Research staff. That's what I want to be. Okay. How many of you have not been here for one of the 2 days? Has everybody been here? No? Okay. We've been talking about a couple of different things so far, and today's talk is going to be a little bit different. Talked about kind of three hard facts. That until about 10,000 years ago, societies were very simple. Groups were typically about 30 people or less. Very few large groups at all. There's no archaeological evidence of that. About 200 years ago, societies changed dramatically. We call this the Neolithic Revolution 10,000 years ago, the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago. Mel last night wanted to push us back to 250 or whatever. And that's, I think, okay in an intellectual sense. But in terms of when societies actually start to have rising incomes, as there's more physical goods and services being produced, that dates to the middle of the 19th century. About 1840 is the first date at which we can document that. So we're not even quite up to 200 years ago on that. But there's also political, economic, social, religious changes that go. Those of you who heard Butch talk about Scott Joplin, the Maple Red came out in 1899, who was a black composer who was published by a white publisher, that this kind of not only swept the nation, but swept the world. And this was part, in fact, of a bigger sweeping of a change in the entire way the world was organized. And the third thing is no genetic change. And I think yesterday we talked about brains, which is kind of crazy. Why am I talking about how society is organized in brains? And I'm an economist. I don't know anything about brains. But I told some stories, and I'm sorry if I kind of wandered yesterday afternoon, but everybody else wandered too, because this is kind of neat stuff, how the brain works. And I'm interested in sort of rational decisions. Economists typically assume that people make rational decisions, but economists are beginning to learn that people aren't always rational. I want to lose 20 pounds. I say I want to lose 20 pounds. I have a pizza. No. How does that work? Where does that come from? Okay. And then, in fact, that our rational decisions are framed by emotional responses. And there's a part of our brain which is automatic, the autonomic system, that's sometimes called the reptile brain, which is generates feelings. I don't feel good. I have nausea. I got chills. I got whatever. They come out of a part of our brain that we have no conscious control of. The middle brain, which is sometimes called the limbic system, where emotions tend to register, and lots of things happen here fast, and this is very intuitive, and it's tied to feelings. And then we have the neocortex, which is the rational brain, the brain that actually calculates. So the image I had from a book called The Emotional Brain by Joseph Ledoux is you're walking down the path to Holden Lake, and you see a stick on the side of the path. What's your first reaction? Right? And you get a jolt of adrenaline shock, your eyes light up, your irises get bigger, and boom. And that's happening here. Do you have any control over that? No, because if you had to stop and think of whether it was a snake or not, you might be dead before you figured it out. So you react, and then this part of your brain says, is it a stick or a snake? Okay, now that's a snap, snap, slam, bang decision. But in fact, all of our inputs are wired into both of these parts of our brain, and this part of our brain actually is sets our mood, frames things. And behavioral economists and behavioral psychologists have shown that you can actually influence people's decisions by framing the problem that they're facing in different kinds of ways. So if you do an experiment with college students, where they bargain and you give them a Hershey kiss before they come in, they tend to be more generous. It was a great experiment they did this at the MIT labs, where they would have people, they paid them to come into the lab, and they just talked to them, and then they let them go. But they told them they had to leave the building. So they timed how long it took them to walk from the door of the lab to the exit to the building. So if they talked to them about Florida aging and arthritis, they walked to the door more slowly. Okay. Now, I don't want to get in trouble. They did a thing with Asian American women. They came in and they talked to them.
If they talked to them about being women and then asked them questions about math, they did poorly. They did less well than if they talked to them about being Asian. So what's the frame? Okay. So, and we have all kinds of things. And so when we say rational decision, this is the part of our brain that can do the math problems. This is the part of the brain that frames the problems that this part of the brain is solving. And this part of the brain, for good reason, sometimes has control. Not this part of the brain. And this part of the brain says, I want to lose 20 pounds. But this part of the brain says, that pizza looks really good. And right now, that's my treasure. Okay? That's what's in my interest to do. Now, we need to understand this process about how humans do this because, and we have lots of discussions this week about treasure. You know, what do people value? Okay. And as I said the other night, economists believe that people value different things, and we can't really externally know anything about what people value. That it's revealed by their actions and how they behave. So I've had lots of conversations. You know, as I said, Grace scares me. This whole notion that, you know, no matter what I do, it's grace through faith that this whole relationship with God is about. And, you know, so several people have talked to me about that, and I've kind of said, you know, the more I learn about how societies work, the more I realize what I think is right and wrong, what feels to me like human nature, is not a given. Okay? Because the emotional part of our brain learns from our experience. So this is, we're wired this way not because what's given to us is absolute and an inherent part of human nature, because how we feel about things depends upon the world that we live in. Because our emotions are a way for our brain to help us make decisions more quickly or in more complicated environments to actually solve problems intuitively that we cannot solve rationally by calculation. So that means when we all talk about something we all understand as part of human nature and is good and moral and right, that means we have a common experience, which makes us feel that way. And whenever we say that, are there people in the crowd who disagree? Yeah, they do, but they don't say it, usually. Right? And so our feelings about our intuition about what is right to do, what is appropriate to do, is embedded in this process. And I'm not a moral philosopher. I don't even know what ethics means. Let me ask you the other day, as David quotes, analyze my answer. He doesn't know. but we do want to take into account this fact that people make decisions through a process that's inherently part of being human that cannot be completely distilled to rationality, to how this part of the brain operates. But nonetheless, this part of the brain does operate. And so as Dorothy commented to me yesterday, you seem to be playing both sides of the street here. People can be rational and make choices. And on the other hand, people are conditioned. And sometimes the choices they make are influenced by things that they don't might have very much control over. Boy, and I think that's absolutely right. And I want both those things to be here. I don't want to have to choose one model or the other. And those of you who heard Mel's talk last night, he had on the board five pieces of literature, five writings. Well, the first one was Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. Second was Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto, and then several three papal encyclicals. And I've read the first two, not the last three. But those are sometimes they're very powerful ideas in those books. And partly the ideas shape how people think about the world and how they interpret the world. They are, however, rationalizations about the world. They are literally these kind of constructions that are logically, totally logically consistent. And while they help us understand how the world works, they're problematic in understanding how the pieces of the world actually fit together. Okay? Because we are people, and as individuals, the way we're structured enables us to deal with groups of about 30. And so when we move to bigger groups, now, can anybody tell me why I've got no genetic change as my third cold hard fact here? See where I'm going?
10,000 years is not long enough.
Yeah, but why do I want to have no genetic change?
Because we are genetically prepared to work with 30 people,
yeah.
And the population has exploded, and we don't know how to do that.
No, but the population didn't explode until we figured out how to work with more. Right? So 10,000 years ago, we do start getting bigger groups. What can explain that change?
Well,
Changing how we thought.
What?
Changing how we thought.
Yes, changing how we think, or somehow, could it be a change in the genetic wiring?
No.
No, I'm ruling that out.
For now.
Okay. For now. But the biologists are pretty clear about ruling this out, too. And what's the second cold hard fact? 200 years ago, things really changed. And that is too fast. Okay, and the whole mold, we have too much stuff, we have too much advertising, all these kinds of things. Our change is not in how our brain works, but our change is in the way society is organized. Remember last night with Mel that the Catholic social work doctrine says that the model for society is the family. As we talked about yesterday, people are geared to deal with groups of about 30 people because we trust, and David, the sexuality document is called?
Trust, Gift and Trust.
Gift and Trust, okay. And it's about how do we create situations in which people can trust one another. We are genetically endowed with an ability to build relationships which enable us to trust people who we know. Now, sometimes we trust them because we know that they're not trustworthy. Right? We trust them to be who they are. Okay. But it's incredibly difficult for us to get beyond 30. And most of human history until 10,000 years ago is groups of 30 people or less. And in fact, in what I'm going to talk about today, call this the foraging order. We used to call this the primitive order, but then the anthropologists got really upset. You can't call those people primitive. Okay. The stuff I'm going to talk about today comes from a book called Violence and Social Orders. It's in the bookstore. It's available on Amazon. And the bookstore said that they would match Amazon's prices. I've talked about this. Holden's actually acknowledged in here. I've talked about this over the last three summers. And I'm going to talk about social orders, how larger societies are sustained. And it's a historical question that only occurs 10,000 years ago. And I'm going to rule out a possibility that this is caused by some genetic change. Okay? That is, it's caused by some change in the organization of society, which is not reflected in the organization of the family. Okay? Because if the family was a model for organizing a larger society, we would have had larger societies 2 million years ago. Because we're set up, we're wired to deal with families. We're wired to deal with extended families, right? Like the document says. We can do that. In fact, incredibly interesting biological literature about, you know, parents come together, which is kind of an odd thing. You know, right? Sexual intimacy, all the ties that bind. And parents typically aren't related to one another, but every child of every parent shares half their genes. Brothers and sisters share a quarter of their genes. There's enormously powerful predictions about how people interact based on how genetically similar they are. Now, the kicker for this is, guess how closely related bees are to each other?
Totally.
Well, no. Can they be totally? Not totally. What? They can't be totally if you're having people, you know, coming together. We have a mother and a father. They each contribute half their genetic material. There's a random chance that you'll get half from each. Okay, you know, my son Dexter looks much more like me now than Dan does. Dan looks much more like his mother does. Right? But Dan's feet look like my feet. It's this random thing. In bees, you know, hive insects are very closely related. They're willing to die for each other. It turns out that they're all sisters. Almost all of them, so they share, they have much higher levels of genetic sharing than humans do. They don't, the mating process does not produce the same kind of genetic variation within most of the population. Anyway, I don't want to go into the math of this. There's some very powerful predictions about how different species should interact. Now, this is completely unconscious, right? Because I don't go around saying, oh, Dexter's got a half, you know. He's about to step in front of the truck, but, you know, that's the stupid half, so let him go ahead. You know? We're here to do that within families. How do we get past 30 people? And so that's really the discussion that I want to have today. I talked yesterday about incomplete relationships, that we're capable of dealing with each other in small enough groups where the relationship is what matters, is what sustains us. And economists would have a way of saying this. It's called the folk theorem, which as long as you have a relationship with somebody that goes into the future, you may be willing to have an interaction with somebody today in which you lose, which you're worse off, because you don't want to forego the gains of the relationship in the future. Why do people pay their mortgages back? Well, because they might want to borrow again. I mean, every loan contract has incentives for the borrower to split right after the contract is made, after the loan is made. And the lender has incentives to make sure the borrower is going to pay him back. And so we have arrangements to do that. Now, have you ever lent money to your brother-in-law and not been paid back? Maybe that shows you how strong families are. Right? But if you borrow from somebody impersonally, you want to have a contract. We talked yesterday about how, with Phil and Marcia, I don't think, is Marcia here? You know, had an arrangement where they could go together, but they could look down the road and see, we're going to be in a circumstance, we can cooperate as long as we have this long-term relationship, but we can see maybe down the road that our relationship is going to break up. That one party or the other will have an incentive to defect. And so we talked about how they could adopt an arrangement, like Phil's son could go live with Marcia, and Marcia's son could go live with Phil. That would be called a hostage.
Okay.
You ever heard about Polybius? One of my favorite historians. He was a Greek who grew up in Rome in the 2nd century BC. He lived in the household of the Scipio family. Scipio Africanus was the Roman general who conquered Carthage. He's a very famous political theorist. He was a son of a Greek leader who was taken hostage. So he grew up in Rome, even though his dad lived in Macedonia, because they didn't want this was the way for the Romans to control his father. Now, it wasn't a way for the Romans to control his father directly. They didn't say, you know, change your policy or we'll shoot your kid. Right? Because what was most important was the relationship, right? Not the contract. We're geared to deal with people in terms of relationships, not in terms of rules. When we deal with people in terms of rules, we deal with people completely differently. And we know typically not very effectively. Dexter was going to be a lawyer when he was young. Because as soon as I got a rule, man, he was right on the edge. You know? No TV? What? Oh, no, what about this? What about that? What about this 3 minutes? What about that 5 minutes? You have kids like that? All of us have kids like that. Because as soon as you set up a rule, the human nature is, let's get around the rule. Okay? So we're not rule-bound people. We're relationship-bound people. That's what this tells us. We have a brain, part of our brain, which is geared towards sensing emotions in other people. It's geared towards emotion. But we also know that we're going to coordinate with people, that relationships won't do it. I feel unified with all 300 million Americans, but, you know, I'm just not personally connected to each other. And I don't trust them because I'm personally connected to them. So how do we get to the point where we can build larger relationships? We have to do it through hostages are an extreme example, but they happen all the time. Bonding is another way. So that Phil and Marcia could each put $1,000 in the bank or in a pot. Ever made a bet at a bar when the bartender holds the bet? Right? And then depending on who wins, the bartender passes it out. So they bound themselves and said, as long as we continually persist in our relationship, the money will be there. The person who defects, the other person gets the money. That's just a way to create a wedge so that both parties have an incentive to continue to cooperate. That's how an economist would see it. Political science sociologists, psychologists wouldn't see it in those terms at all. They'd say, what does it take to get this ongoing relationship? You know, what does it take to build a community? What is it? You know, economists have a different way of thinking about it. Why is it that people value their relationships? Comps has a cold, dark way of looking at it because we don't know why people value things. So we're not saying that they love their children or anything. We're just looking at what they do. But we can see that they want to create these incentives to continue to cooperate. So the one piece that I haven't put into this yet is violence. What role does violence play in the human sexuality thing?
Not part of the discussion that I know.
Well, you didn't know. You did talk about
You did talk
guarded
a lot
against
about
violence.
What?
Guarded against violence.
Yeah. That there's all kinds of elements of human sexuality that have this underlying element of violence. And any part of the relationship that involves violence, church is against. Right? But it's inevitable in any kind of relationship that violence is part of the deal. It's particularly true in any kind of personal relationship. Okay. I'm bigger than most of you in the room. Dexter's bigger than me. Bill's bigger than Dexter. We're going to live in a world where we're going to put the meat in the middle and go first. Who's going to go first? Well, potentially Phil, right? Because he's biggest. And those of you who are small, we'll get even smaller as you don't eat. Okay, now, if you think about a relationship world with 30 people, is that how they divide up the food? No, they don't. In fact, hunting and gathering tribes, foraging tribes, tend to be what anthropologists call aggressively egalitarian. The game is you split everything equally. Okay. Now that encourages participation. It's kind of like a gift, a reciprocal exchange economy. When the big hunter goes out and brings back the game, the big hunter does not get the best piece of meat. In fact, the big man, the guy who's a leader, shows that he's a leader by doing what? Giving stuff away, right? As you lead from the back. And that's a very, very common way of organizing hunting and gathering societies. In fact, it's almost a universal. These places are aggressively egalitarian. If Phil says, I'm bigger than you, and pushes us all out of the way and gets the meat, which he could do, the next day we start telling jokes about Phil. Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. Did you wash your hands last night? Yeah. Is that a mustache or is that grease? Then if he does it again, right? Then we started saying, you know, Phil, you just can't do it. We start talking to him. And then if he does it again, we say, you know, Phil, you're just not welcome at the table. You're out of the community. But if he still comes back, when he goes to sleep, we kill him. And who's like, who do we want to have kill him? Joan. His wife. Why?
She's there. She's
no. What do we not want to have start happening in our community?
A vendetta.
We do not. We want his brother to kill him or his wife to kill him because we don't want his brother to come after the rest of us who killed him. Even though he knows it was a good thing to kill Phil, he's bound by honor to all those kind of personal relationships that really make these societies incredibly difficult to deal with. Violence is endemic in small societies. Vendettas, all kinds of things, part of the problem. And so one of the reasons that we groups are small and that we limit them is because there's a persistent threat of violence in relationships. People get mad. Right? And my father was a wonderful person. I loved him dearly. He had a temper. He would take his belt out when I was a kid. Whap! Whenever I hit my sister. Now, that today that would be we'd all, you know, he'd be in jail and I'd be whatever. Because social norms have changed. But that was, you know, I was scared of my dad. Dexter will tell him, I'm really scared of my dad. You know, why? Well, you know, I scared him sometimes. Because I'm his dad. It isn't because I beat him or anything. It's just part of, you know, we know this, right? That there's some people are really scared. Violence is a real problem. In relationships. We want to live in a society where we suppress that, but we live in groups of 30 and there's other groups of 30 revolving around. It's really, really tough to control violence. And the way we control it historically in human history is through dealing with small groups of people who we can trust. It doesn't mean there's not a lot of violence. A lot. What is the statistics on murder? That more than half the murders occur between people who knew one another. Right? Because somebody got pissed off about something. So it's not like human nature is we're all peaceful. It would be nice, but we have to deal with violence. So how do we do that? How do we create incentive for people not to be violent? Now, 3 years ago, in 2006 when I came, there was two old friends from Holden, from actually earlier days. One was named Don Johnson, and the other was John Beck. So we had what we called the Don John. And then the tape of that session was played in high school. So when I came back, oh, talk to us about Don John. But I had different people. You know, I had, what's your name?
Aaron.
Aaron, you're Don. And you're?
Christine.
You're John. Okay. No, so we're going to have a memorial Don John lecture with Aaron and Christy, with Don and John. Okay. So how are we going to solve this problem of violence? Well, let's divide the room in half. There's roughly, you know, there's more, not quite 30, but there's two groups that are related to one another. And John and Don are the leaders of the groups, but they lead from the back. You know, they might be old, they might be wise, they might be smart, they might be whatever they are. And they're trying to figure out a way to get together. The problem is that they're potentially violent. They have rocks and sticks. You know, so we're talking about Bronze Age Neolithic people. So they have tools. And so John and Don get together and say, you know, let's not fight. Let's bring our groups together. Let's have 60 people or 100 people. Let's live together in peace. And they suggest that they put down their rocks. And as soon as they put down their rocks, what does John do? Kills Don. Right? I mean, if I kill you, I take all their stuff. I'm richer. Okay, how do we...
That means I tricked him.
You tricked him, yeah. Which means that if he can look down the game, we say look down the game tree, look ahead in the future, and knows that if he puts us down his rock, you're going to kill him, will he put down his rock? No, that's called rational expectations. You know, you don't. Hopefully, all of you have some of that embedded in you. There's also a very fancy macroeconomic term with that. But that if you're with somebody who has a rock, and he says, "Put down your rock, I'll be nice to you." Put down the rock. What's the story about? You know, the scorpion and the fox and the cow. Aesop's fable. The scorpion says, "Oh no, carry me across the river. I won't sting you in the middle of the river." The scorpion stings the cow, grabs they both dead, and the cow says, "What are you doing? We're both dead." He says, "Oh, it's my nature." Right? So how can these two jokers figure out a way to reach an agreement in which they are not going to be violent? Now, what I'm going to do is describe to you an arrangement of the logic of it, but it's really too simple, but it'll make sense, and then we'll come back and see how societies actually do this in more realistic terms. And I'm not saying this is a historical process, because this all happened beginning 10,000 years ago. Nobody was writing anything down, so I can't test this in a direct way. Suppose John and Don said, look, let's keep our rocks, but let's divide the world in half. I own all the people, all the land, all the stuff over here, and you own all the land, all the people, all the stuff over here. And we'll make an agreement that whenever I call for help, you come and help me. Now, here's what happens. Land, labor, and capital, the three factors of production we learned about last night from Mel, on both sides of in both groups, are more productive if they don't fight. Because when violence breaks out, everybody has to devote resources to protecting themselves. They don't produce as much stuff. In this world, Don and John have, in fact, united together to make themselves stronger than everybody else. Can you kill Don when he sleeps? No, because if you do, what will John do?
Kill you.
Okay. The whole aggressively egalitarian business about 30 people has changed. Now, why can Don and John trust that the other won't, that they won't kill each other? Why?
Because that would produce more security.
Yeah, but why is the society is going to produce more if they don't fight, right? Mm-hmm. But that in and of itself doesn't give Don and John incentives to not fight unless the stuff that gets produced belongs to them. Right? So by them establishing property in you, they have an incentive not to fight. Make sense? If Don thinks she can take over the whole world, then she fights. This is not an ironclad. John's not safe. In fact, the two people that are most paranoid in this room are Don and John. They're always looking over their shoulder. Okay. But what's happened is they've made an arrangement We could say they're personal, but that's not the deal here. They know each other, and they know that they're cutthroats, right? So do they trust each other? No, they trust each other in the Ronald Reagan sense. Trust but verify. Okay, so this is a very personal relationship, but it's not a personal relationship in which their ability to trust each other depends upon their personal characteristics as individuals. It depends upon the arrangement that they have both made. Now, if we go back to Monday, I said, we want to explain something about rules, or about laws, or about institutions, about arrangements that happen. This is, of course, their agreement's not going to be written down on paper. It's not going to be a formal law. But it is going to be an agreement they made. And what makes this agreement self-enforcing would be the words that economists would use. What makes their agreement stable, which makes the rule, because the rule in this society now is that Don and John own everything. Did you guys agree to this?
No,
you didn't have actually any say in it, maybe. Okay, and your agreement is not required for their agreement to work. But their agreement must be incentive compatible, is what we would say. It must be the case that both Don and John find it in their interest to cooperate. Now, what makes them cooperate? Well, if you think about all the peons on this side of the room being little d's, and all the peons on that side of the room being little j's, what's happened is that Don and John interacting with one another in this way make all the little d's more productive. And interacting this way make all the little j's more productive, right? Because they can limit violence. Whereas in the previous world, you never knew when the other group was going to show up and start beating up on you. So you always devoted some serious resources to defending yourself, which meant you produced less stuff or had less leisure because you had to worry about defending yourself. There's this tribe, the Yanomamo, in the Amazonian rainforest, that famous case because they were very isolated. And they're a tribe, they're a group of about 1,000 people. They spend all their time attacking each other. And so they devoted an enormous amount of their resources to defending each other, defending themselves from each other. And so if you get two guys in charge, so everybody else becomes unarmed in some sense, what happens to productivity? It goes up because the rest of you aren't spending all your time trying to protect each other. But moreover, the problem of coordination has now changed. In a group of 30, everybody's got to be more or less equal. That's the way it works. Okay, that's the way we're wired. That's the way the relationships are. That's why a family is such a good deal. Of course, are things equal in a family? Well, in my family, I was just first among equals. Of course, I had the loudest voice. I was biggest. I had a job. So I wasn't equal. There was a hierarchy there.
The oldest?
Yeah, I was the oldest. And I thought I was the smartest. None of my siblings did. But, that was my family. Then my dad was. Okay, so what's happening here is that the hierarchy of the family, which does not extend to the band, because the band, although the band has all kinds of unique personal social relationships, is now being extended to the fact where two people really are patriarchs, and they are different from the rest of the people because of the virtue of their alliance with each other. And that means that the kind of bonding and contracting kind of arrangements between Don and the little D's don't have to be based on relationships in the same way now, because Don can call on John. Right? So this group, which was initially limited in size to 30, because every relationship had to, in fact, be in everybody's interest, now this group can get much bigger, because Don can call on the resources of John to enforce agreements within here. They can, in fact, effectively coerce people. So this group can get bigger, and as it gets bigger, it gets more productive. Yep.
And to add to it, I don't want to, maybe you're going to get to that, is of course that if John's daughter marries Don's
right.
You actually create the kind of relationship that you're talking about. And if you look at European dynasties or others, that was a common way of forging relationships.
Absolutely. In fact,
I'm going to come back to that in just a second, that kind of arrangement, because that then, this business about family, we're not.
I don't want to dehumanize anybody.
And in fact, I don't want to drop anything we've been talking about the last 2 days. Everything here must be consistent with that way we've been talking about how people are. Right, that they do have emotions, they do frame their decisions, they make rational decisions in the context of the way they perceive the problem, so that all kinds of personal relationships that bind one another, we would expect particularly Don and John to use. Right? So yeah, Don actually might, this is really important, and at the heart of it's at the heart of modern societies. When we talked about the Phil and Marcia agreement, we talked about having the bartender hold the best. What's the bartender in that story?
The bank.
What?
The bank.
He's the bank. But is he part of the bet? No, he's called a third party. Okay? So what's the stake to most of the contracts? The third party. Okay? Are there third parties in hunter-gatherer groups?
No.
Yeah, there's not third parties. Everybody's part of the same deal. So we want to have a bartender, okay, to hold the bets, to enable these relationships to get over the rocky parts. So we want to have incomplete relationships that have part of the relationships held together by a contract or by a rule or by the bartender who holds the bets. But who's going to be the third party? That's a really hard problem to solve. Because whoever gets to be the third party, we have exactly the same problems, which is he will walk away with the money. Okay? Why do we want the bartender to hold the bets? Why don't we just pick up somebody at the bar? Well, because the bartender's going to be back tomorrow night. Right? And people won't come to his bar if he gets a reputation for, you know, we can do the same relationship thing with the bartender. But that's okay. And we're talking about, but as soon as we start talking about violence, we got a real problem. If we make Don and John powerful, what's to prevent them from exploiting the rest of us?
Nothing.
Okay. How do we create a third party so that within Don's group, we can have third party enforcements of arrangements? Who's the third party? John. And who's the third party for arrangements within John's group?
Don.
And a credible arrangement, Don and John can in fact trust each other, but not trust each other in the sense of a family. They can trust each other because Don can see that if John fights, John is going to lose the productivity of the rest of you. And that creates a wedge that enables them to cooperate. That make sense? Now, that means that this is not just like a family. Okay? The relationship between Don and John is not, it is in a sense an artificial relationship. It's a relationship that's socially constructed. And it depends upon rules between Don and John that coordinate their activity. That is also dependent upon John's relationship to the J's and Don's relationships to the D's. These are of a piece. If Don and John's relationship is inconsistent with their culture or their ethnic heritage or their tribal rules, it won't work. Because potentially, if all the J's get together, what can they do? Kill John. Have you ever read, I think it's David Hume who says this, that no government ever governs by force. Because if it really governed by force, the leaders are always a small percentage of the people. The people would just stand up and kill the leaders. So people enslave themselves. Okay. There's a famous anthropologist named Elmon Service who says, large societies wage peace, not war. You know, the last thing Don and John want is fighting. They want these guys to be productive. The logic of this, and you guys have just grasped an incredibly powerful economic concept, which is, where do third parties come from? How do societies create third parties? If we go back to our, and I'm going to put this graph back up in a minute.
this is time. This is per capita income or health or population or any, a lot of things that we want to have in this. It's like this until 8,000 BC. Goes up and then here's 1840. This is a graphic representation of the first two hard cold facts. Mm-hmm. When do rules come into play? Right there. Okay. What we just did, although it's not, the relationship between John and Don is not a formal law, it is nonetheless a rule. It's a kind of way of ordering behavior that everybody can see and understand that this is the way the things are ordered. Okay, we might call it a social norm, or we would call it an institution. We've got lots of different words that we kind of play for this with. But at this point, we change the way the pieces of society interact in such a way that the societies can get larger. And so the first place in the historical record, the archaeological record that we see, is a place called Settle Hewitt or Kettle Hewitt. There's lots of different ways to say it. In the Anatolian Plateau of Turkey today, and it's the oldest large living habitation, and it has 8,000 people living in it. So we go from 30 to 8,000. Because this Don John world is scalable. It's hierarchical. And you can put lots of pieces together. Question?
Yeah, could you give maybe like an example to the Don and John from history of two...
Yeah, Mel, where's Mel? Mel, tell us about the Catholic Church. Was Mel here? I keep doing this. I shouldn't ask. Yeah, think about the Catholic. We talked about the Catholic Church last night. That the Catholic Church was really pissed off after they lost their dominant position, because in fact, this is a great lead-in for going back to the prior graph. We've got Don and John. And the little D's and the little J's. Well, how did Don and John mobilize the resources of the people they control? And you actually have to get the stuff. So one of the things they do... What's your name?
Amber.
Amber and...
Vince.
Amber and Vince, they become priests. Okay. And Paul and...
Mary.
They become traders. So we get Don and Don's priest and Don's trader, John and John's priest and John's trader. Okay. Now, if you want to, immediately upon creating stability and peace, you want to trade. And Don and John have an incredible incentive to get trade across the room, because allowing specialization and division of labor will cause growth, will cause more output. And they get to keep it. So, but how are they going to mobilize? Well, they're going to have a couple priests, they're going to have a temple. And this temple, everybody is going to grow their food and bring it to the temple every year. And then the temple's going to feed everybody. And the rule is going to be God provides for everyone. Right? Is Patricia here? Right? No? I keep asking. I should look, but it's hard to see. The story, if you're about Bible study on Monday, we talked about the rich man who comes to Christ and says, what do I need to do to follow you? Christ said, you follow the commandments? He said, yes. And then Christ says, you only lack one thing. You got to sell all your wealth and give it to the poor. And the guy goes away unhappy and sorrowful. Apparently, he couldn't do that. Guess what the next story is? If you follow me, everyone who follows me, everyone who puts down their life and follows me will be rewarded 100 times over. Okay? Put your grain in the granary and you will be rewarded 100 times over. Now, who controls the grain? These two. Who controls the trade? These two. They all have an incentive to participate in the Don John arrangement. They're undoubtedly going to wear better clothes, be richer. Okay. But they provide a very stable set of social relationships in which more things can happen both in these groups and between these groups. Okay. They're going to create social institutions which are all based on relationships. But nonetheless are incomplete relationships because they rely in part on the rules. Was anybody on Monday night happy just talking about relationships and human sexuality?
No.
They all wanted to know, what are the damn rules? what is this thing about, you know, the roster stuff? We know that we ought to love one another. We know that all this stuff ought to be happening. It's all great. Tell us what the rules are. Don't tell us what the rules are because we want to live by the rule. Tell us what the rules are because we can't structure our relationships until we know what the rules are. Should I be fond of this gay pastor? Should we try calling him or her? I don't know because I don't know what the rules are. We live in the shadow of the rules. We live in relationships in the shadow of the rules. The gospel deactivates the law, but it doesn't make the law go away. If we can live in relationships, we are much more productive, but those relationships have to occur in the shadow of rules if we're to deal with people that we do not know intimately and personally. Where do those rules come from? That is a really, really, really important question. Because they don't come on stone tablets. Only in the Bible does it come that way. They come from our social interaction. If the rules that are loosely embedded in the Don John world break down, what happens? Chaos.
Violence.
In fact, what's the biggest threat to this society? Don and John. That they will decide to try to kill each other. Read Federalist Paper number 10, which was written by James Madison in an attempt to explain, to convince the people of New York and the American people to ratify the Constitution in 1787. It's all about fear of faction. And it's all about how can we design a government that will prevent civil war. They didn't. We had one. They tried. We've changed, you know, we've adapted to the rules a little bit. The biggest problem societies have is breaking down internally. It's the powerful individuals within the society going after one another. How do we prevent that from happening? Now, the reason that I wanted to talk over the last 2 days about how people work is that people are inherently capable of organizing themselves in small groups, but they are not inherently capable of organizing themselves in large groups unless there's third parties. Right? That if I'm going to deal with people that I don't know intimately, then I have to have a bartender to hold the bets. I have to have some looking down into the future. Right? Some, because I know that at some point, the other person who I'm dealing with is going to have an incentive to defect, to cheat me, to abandon the relationship. So I want some insurance that that's not going to happen. And if everybody has to give everybody their only begotten son, we're not going to get very far. But if we can get a bartender to hold the bets, then that gets pretty expensive because then the bartender has to hold the money. What if we just say, David's the bartender? Oh, no, let's have Ron and John be the bartender. Don and John. Right? So that we'll reach agreements, and they'll promise to enforce the agreement. So whenever they break, Don and John come in and say, okay, here's the rules. We're going to divide it up. Now, the rules could be Don and John get everything. The only rule could be Don comes to John's aid and John comes to Don's aid. That could be the first rule, which will dramatically change their relationships with the rest of you. It's a very simple rule. It's not a fair rule. It's not a right rule. Everybody will think this is unfair. Right? All of our notions about human justice and dignity will be violated by this. All of our relationships will say, that's not right. But guess what? They'll kill you. Okay? So, the key to this arrangement is who in any of the other organizations in society have access to the rules that Don and John will enforce. Only DP and DT, only Amber and Paul, Vince and Mary. Now remember that it's really important for Don and John to cooperate, that they get what an economist would call a rent. And I need to explain this word a little bit more, but it's a very powerful concept. It's not, rent is not what you pay to your landlord, although that's another definition of rent. If I was willing to, okay, so I come to Holden Village for free, okay? But let's say I was willing to pay $1,000 to come, which I probably would be. You can't come unless you pay $1,000 to bring your family. And of course,
if I had to pay you to let me talk to you, it could be really expensive. Right? Because we usually set up the deal where, you know, you might pay me to talk to you, but it could be, you know, what happens if I have to pay you? That turns out to be one of those mid-brain things. What do people expect is going to happen? So let's say I was willing to come for $1,000, but I get to come for free. I get a rent of $1,000. That is, I get a return. It's not $1,000, because I'm not getting any dollars, but I get the utility, the treasure, the value, the interest of that. Now, if Carol sends me an email and says, you know, we'd like to have you back, but we'd also like a check for $250, what will I do? I'll send her the check. Right? Because I'm not trying to monetize this, because, and that has some, let's say it was apples. You know, if you'd bring 250 cases of apples with you, you can come. You know, I would do that, right? It would mean, what would happen to my rent? It would go down, okay? But I'd still get it. Now, the key here with the relationship between Don and John is that we want there to be significant rents in this relationship. We want Don and John to get well above the value. We want them to get in return much more than their cost of participating in the relationship, because that means in small changes, Don and John will still participate. If I get a letter from Carol that says, we'd like you to come up next summer, we want 1,000 cases of apples on the bus at the dock before we let you into the village, I say, hasta la bye-bye. I'm not coming. Yeah. Now, how many of you eat food? And how many of you shop, I should say? And not, you know, some of us, not all of us. You know, I used to shop all the time, I don't anymore. When you go to the store and the price of apples has gone up, what do you do?
Buy oranges.
What?
Buy oranges.
Okay. What does that say about the rent you're getting from buying apples? It's very small. So if the price went up a little bit, you stopped buying apples. What if you really love apples? You're willing to pay $10 a pound for apples and they sell for a dollar. What's your rent per pound?
$9.
I'm putting dollars on here because it's easy to do the math. If you're willing to pay $10 a pound for apples and the price goes from $1 to $2, you keep buying apples. But if you're willing to buy apples for $1.10, like Amber is, the price goes to $2, you switch to oranges. Do we want Don and John deciding to go to civil war when the price of apples goes up by 5 cents? No, we don't. In fact, we want Don and John to really enjoy significant returns from this relationship. We want these guys to enjoy significant returns because we don't want them to be violent. Right? So how do we do that? How do we ensure that they get rents? Well, we do it by giving them the right to organize people. And only them the right to organize people. If you wanted to be a Lutheran in 1517, you went to the church at Wittenberg and you pounded some stuff on the door and says, we ought to change this stuff, we ought to reorganize the church. What did the church do? We're going to kill you. Cold, hard fact. The Catholic Church wanted to go back to the Middle Ages because in the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church was D, not even DP. They were better organized than the monarchs, than the states. The divine right of kings does not mean that the kings are ordained by God. That's the window dressing on it. The divine right of kings is an argument between the kings and the church, which says the people who select the king should be the kings, not the pope. That the pope does not have the power to invest the king with kingship, to ordain or bless the king. That the king holds this right by himself, which means we don't need this joker pope or bishop or archbishop here to make me who I am. And in fact, when does this become a problem? After 1517. You don't hear about divine right of kings in the 12th century. You hear about it when the church is because of the breaking up of the organization of the church. Right? And of course, does it matter to Luther that his prince defends him?
Yes.
Yes.
What's the reference? It's a civil war. Yeah. It's a civil war where hundreds of thousands of people die. Okay, it's a breakdown in order. Now, it has all kinds of other kinds of reasons that we're glad it happened, and all that sort of stuff.
But when the religious identity, the organization of that society, was challenged, and as Mel was talking about, the initial claims of the Protestants were about the organization of the church, not about the fundamental beliefs of the church. Luther believed in the gospel. He believed in, you know, the way the true church needed to be restored by reformation, by reforms that led up to a break of the organization. That the, I call this whole thing the natural state. This is the natural way that human societies have been organized since 10,000 years ago. It works because this is another term, a limited access social order, because only some people have the tools, the access to third-party enforcement. Only some people can form organizations that the larger society will support, that can access the rules. Do people live in the rules? No, they live in relationships. Okay? And those relationships are not rule-bound, they're rule-supported. The difference is, in those societies, these guys had access to different rules than these guys. And in fact, Don and John had access to different privileges and rules and arrangements than Vince and Mary or Amber and Paul. In fact, Paul has a unique set of privileges all his own, and those unique sets of privileges generate rents for Paul, and those rents, those returns to Paul that depend upon him being part of this arrangement, provide Paul with a very strong incentive to coordinate and to cooperate with the other five. I teach at the University of Maryland, and if they lowered my salary $5,000 next year, I would get another job. I'd go somewhere else. It's not because I don't like the University of Maryland, it's because I got other good alternatives, and so the rents I get from working for the University of Maryland are very small. If I'm part of this coalition, it cannot be that there's a small rent that will lead me to defect. The returns to these six from working together and cooperating have got to be very large, otherwise this will break down. In a simple society, a family, what holds people together is the presence of these incredibly large benefits that people get from relating to one another. As soon as parents and children start hating one another, what happens to their family? Woo. Because what holds them together is the rents, is the benefits of the relationship that are at risk if they don't continue to relate to one another. As soon as those benefits disappear, woo, family goes away. Now, what do we treasure? I haven't solved this one yet. Our treasures, rents? I don't know. I treasure my son. There's no cost too high. What does that mean about rents? It means small in some sense, right? Our treasures are what we place value in. Rents are not just related to the value, they're related to the value of opportunities. So they're not quite related to the human nature of these people. Okay? The rents that bind them only exist because of the rules that structure the rest of society. Did that make sense? The interests that these people have are not purely personal. They're generated by the social arrangements. The social arrangements have to be consistent with the interests of everybody. They're unequal, therefore they're not egalitarian. They're unequal, and therefore they're usually very personal. Very personal. But they create a set of incentives that enable a larger society to form.
That's very helpful to me, that last part. And I'd like to say there's hope for your soul after all.
I am a member of the
LC, despite the fact that there's some bishops who believe that because I'm an economist, there's no hope for my soul. But that's okay.
What I've been working on is, as you talk, is I have no problem with your analysis start to finish, but it's economic analysis, which is understandable because you're an economist.
Right.
So if you were to return most of what you said in traditional theological language.
Oh, yeah, right.
The movement from 30 to 100,
yeah.
10,000 years ago, the Garden of Eden story, huge problems with the introduction of rules,
yes.
and a new way, and violence. I mean, right. Fall and Cain and Abel, boom, boom, those two things that entered into society
right.
are highly suspect.
Right.
You know,
but they didn't enter into society, they were already there. Sorry. Well, boop, boop.
That's a question, because what you've done is you've imposed the understandings of the post-issue into the pre-issue.
Right.
And so that's a tension, I agree. This conversation about their rents aren't totally personally, you know, well, we say we're in bondage to sin.
Right.
We cannot free ourselves, that we're right. so conformed by right. the little DJs that we have to do that we can't be our true
yeah.
selves. So all I want to say here is I just want to plant a flag
right.
and say there's another analysis here. I don't know that it's better,
yeah.
but that's why Paul says, man, when I look at this rule thing and think about
right.
why I'm going to lose 20 pounds and eat pizza,
right.
boy, am I messed up.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, the opening sentence of the first chapter of the Communist Manifesto is that there have always been the rich and poor, and they are always at odds with one another. That this world has always been. That this is the fundamental tension of the world. Last night, Mel said, Catholic social work says that this division is wrong.
And Scripture said that's not always been the way. I mean,
right.
Eden is not the way it worked in Eden.
Right.
And
okay.
and the profit motive, which underlines all of your conversation.
No, none of it.
Well, I think too you should bring up violence before civilization.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a question too. Was
okay.
There
okay. So
but we maybe need to stop so people.
Yeah, I know. I'm really. We've gone over time, and so I'll do what Paul Haynes did last night, which is, and even want to keep talking about this because we had, you know. About a half a dozen hands shoot up a minute ago. And I'm quite willing to continue this conversation right now, but I don't want to bind anybody to be here who wants to go to lunch or do whatever. So, okay. But I think Paul Hinderle's point about violence is really, really important. There's a big debate in anthropology going on right now about whether foraging, hunting and gathering societies are inherently violent. Those of you who were here 2 years ago, I spent a lot of time that summer talking about violence. And we had who was the pastor who did the Bible studies that week about violence? I forget his name. It'll come to me. Senior moment, it'll come to me. That if you look at hunting and gathering societies, that they appear to be actually quite violent. So on Saturday, a co-author and I are giving a paper at Simon Fraser University. I won't be there. I'll be up here getting on the bus. And Rick... is called an oxologist. He's an economist, but he studies human dimensionality. Franz Boas, the famous American anthropologist, said we ought to be studying anthropometrics. We ought to be studying how tall people are, how fat people are, what they do. And it turns out anthropologists study their bones. So they go somewhere and they find 200 skeletons and they study their skeletons and they communicate to one another. But they don't pool the information very well. And of course, without computers, it's difficult to do this. So Rick and a co-author of his got money from the National Science Foundation to get about 200 archaeologists, anthropologists, physical anthropologists together to sort of pool their skeletons and to adopt a common metric for measuring the skeletons. That was, you know, the length of the femur turns out to be strongly related to your height, so you can measure height by looking at the length of some bones. But most importantly, come up with common metrics for disease and injuries, as recording them in a common framework. And as you may know today, forensic anthropology, there's Aaron Elkins is a mystery writer who has a bone doctor. He solves crimes by looking at skeletons. That there are certain kinds of injuries which are highly correlated with human-induced trauma. So arrowheads in the skull, an obvious one. But injuries to the arms and to the face, the front of the face, are highly correlated. So if you go through these 12,000 skeletons and you write down all the visible injuries, and all the disease and all that kind of stuff. And then it turns out about, for about 6,000 of the skeletons, you can actually locate the size of the place that the skeleton was living in when they died. Were they hunters and gatherers and foragers? Were they living in a village? Were they living in a town? Of course, this is related to material society, so there's things that the skeletons are buried with, and it is a complicated kind of deal. Then you say, well, we've got hunter-gatherers, and we've got townsmen, and we've got villagers. And then Rick, because this is his origin, he had the injuries for black males in 19th century southern cities. Okay? So a group that was subject to Jim Crow laws, lynching laws, lots of violence. Guess which group had the highest incidence of violence? So we got hunter-gatherers, villages, towns, and 19th century black males.
Hunter-gatherers.
Yes. Hunter-gatherers had the highest. The 19th century black males were pretty close. The lowest was the Neolithic city dwellers. Now, it turned out that the Neolithic city dwellers were also the least healthy. They were the shortest, they had the most dental decay, they had the most lesions on their bones that were caused by disease. Diseases leave all kinds of records on your bones so that you can infer something. That it really appears that people who were living in cities were experiencing significant degradations in their health. And there's a mystery about why they would live in cities when they had the option of not. But the answer seems to be that living in larger social organizations actually reduced the overall level of violence. Now, as I said, this is an ongoing debate in anthropology. There's a wonderful book called War Before Civilization by Lawrence Keeley, which was in the bookstore.
It still is.
Still is, which I encourage you all to read. It's very small. You can read it in an afternoon kind of thing. Keeley, analyzing this thing about violence. And in fact, Keeley, when he got out of graduate school, he applied to the National Science Foundation for a study of walls in the Low Countries, in the Netherlands. And he said, I think these are fortifications, but everybody else is just using them to locate the places. And so the NSF, what happens when you submit a grant to the NSF is you get reviewed, you get between 3 and 10 peer-reviewed comments. And the reviewers all said, this is really stupid. Everybody knows that this was a hunting and gathering society and they weren't violent. So these walls had to be something else. Then he reapplied 5 years and he got some positive. And then 10 years later, he reapplied and they said, yeah, we need to study this. Okay? So that the presence of violence is, in human society, goes back a long way. Now, this is why my economics friends say I'm not an economist anymore. Let's go back to these brains. We feel this as human nature. Okay? We all have a feeling about how humans will be. We are endowed with this empathetic sense to sense emotions in other people. We have pieces of our brain that are dedicated to interpreting other people's emotions, interpreting what their face looks like, interpreting their body language, the whole bit. We are keyed into having a concept of human nature. And what's the one that we would like to have? Everybody's peaceful. There was a time when there was no violence. There was a time when everybody worked together. There was a time when everybody loved one another. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that's wrong or right. I'm saying that's a very strong predisposition to model what we think is human nature in ourselves and collectively. And there's a very, very, very strong reason why, as soon as we get a larger society, I don't want to say elites and masses in terms of this hierarchy. The people who are in these positions have a very strong incentive to create common beliefs about the order of this society and its legitimacy for everyone. Okay? And that we are leading us to this, back to this. And that came out so strongly last night in Mel's presentation. You know, that the church, the Catholic Church, responded to the Industrial Revolution by saying, this is wrong and we're leading you. We are restoring the true human values. And that's a very, very, very powerful way of influencing everybody's behavior. Well, Marx said that's the opiate of the people, right? But that's connect. How do we frame our decisions? Amber?
Looking at this social order, the natural state,
yeah.
in terms of like Iran and Mexico and African countries trying to adopt a new social order, namely democracy, and it not working
very well.
Right.
Yeah.
Would you say that, like, we look at them as saying, well, you know, they're not advanced enough for democracy or something.
Right.
It's a new democracy.
Yeah.
Is there an argument to be made that says they're just regressing back into the more natural
social
order?
Yes. I don't want to cut you off.
No, that's it.
Okay. The very much the implications of this line of thinking are that when we want to go to society like Mexico or Iraq and say we're going to produce democracy, because all you need to have for democracy is what?
Constitution.
Elections. Yeah, constitution. Elections. Then it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because this society has a set of social relationships, and its rules make sense for that society, although from our point of view, they don't make any sense at all. Because most of the rules are not written down, and some of the rules are, these guys have a lot of power. Remember Kenya, a year and a half ago, they had an election. And the election was disputed. It was really close. And so what they start doing, anybody remember? They started killing each other. About 1,000 people died. Okay. The opposition party said, we've been robbed. They went into the streets. And literally 1,000 people died. A friend of mine who works with me, who used to be at the World Bank's son, is Alan Webb, who was the first high school miler to break the 4-minute mile since Jim Ryan. So he's a world-class runner. So he has lots of friends who are Kenyans and Ethiopians who are world-class runners who come to the United States. So one of his friends was from Kenya and was really disturbed by what was going on and went home. And immediately upon going home, his friend said, you're coming with us and we're going to go kill this guy. And he went, I'm not doing that. And they said, you're coming with us or we're killing you. Because it was not in Kenya at that point, it really mattered whether you were in Don's world or John's world. Right? Because this became a dividing line for violence. Who you are and whose camp you're in is really important. And we had been actually at the World Bank 2 years ago, and the country economist for Kenya had stood up and said, well, Kenya's a democracy, and we're essentially on the institutional breakthrough of being just like the United States. And my co-author Douglas North, who's 88 years old, turned to me and said, God damn it, Wallace, tell me it's full of blank. Apple butter is the word he uses. Tell me it's full of apple butter. And I said, Doug, I don't know anything about Kenya. I don't know what to say. So I said, Kenya's not, but we didn't have the specific facts about Kenya to say, no, Kenya's probably not there yet. But Kenya blew up. Now what did they do? Kenya changed its rules. It didn't write a new constitution, but it gave John the prime ministership. Guess what else it gave him? The phone monopoly. The phone monopoly. The cell phone monopoly. The Vodafone franchise. In Kenya, was given to that particular political coalition. Now, remember last night when Mel said, oh, in the Middle Ages, the businessmen were subordinate to the church? No. The church was in business. This is a system, and I'll talk about this more tomorrow, that uses economic privilege, right? It uses rents to secure political order. So when we see the system in Kenya, we say, it's corrupt. Right? Now, I'm going to talk about open access tomorrow and on Friday. What happened in 2000 with the election of Bush and Gore? Highly disputed election, extremely close. The hanging chads in Florida were going to decide it. One candidate's brother was the governor of the state. Right? And the process starts going, and all of a sudden, Florida stopped counting and declared George the winner. The Democrats immediately sue, gets up to the Supreme Court, and what's the Supreme Court say? Bush won. Okay, now, what did Americans do? What was the first thing that Al Gore did?
Conceding.
I'm conceding. Why?
So there's not war.
Right. In Kenya, the organization that you belong to is much more important to your well-being than the rules that govern this relationship. In America, the rules that govern our relationships are much more important to us than the identity of the guys who head our political party. If you live in a society where your the organizations you belong to are more important to your value and to your well-being, no matter how you conceive what your treasures are, then the rules, your society will not be a developed country. It will be Mexico, Iraq, Iran. And you cannot change those things overnight because that's the logic of the social order. That's the way that that society coordinates activities. And it's not just the rich exploiting the poor, it's the underlying fundamental structure. Is it rule-based? No, it's relationship-based. And the rules support the relationships. And you want the relationships between the powerful people to be stable. Because if these relationships break down, you get Kenya. And believe me, if you, Chad and Rwanda, Kenya's on the precipice of seeing what's going to happen. We talked about Cambodia last night with Pol Pot. Places that are on the on the edge of chaos are willing to give up a lot not to go there. So it is a real different dynamic. That's why this book is about social orders. I've talked about the second kind today, the natural state. We have a completely different kind of social order. And so our emotions, our response to the way society should work, to what is good and true and just, is really different.
I'm assuming that the violence that they saw early was between the groups of 30, not within the
groups. No, a lot of it's within too.
Yeah. Okay. Because I was going to say, it seems like we're a big failure then because our societies between continue to have.
Was
within the groups, not just between the groups.
Yeah. No, there are more violent societies in general. About how our society is. Is the developed Western world more or less violent than the rest of the world? On a day-to-day basis, much less. The United States is a real outlier because America allows people to carry guns around, which is crazy, in my opinion, but that's my humble opinion. Western Europe doesn't. Israel has much lower levels of violence as well as murder rates. But which society caused the two deadliest wars in human history? Oh, the developed Western world. Oh, yeah, they're really peaceful. Okay, what it is that our societies are so much more powerful because of the forces that we unleashed 200 years ago, that when we go to war, we go to war. And we don't piss around with this, let's have the knights kill each other and, not do the peasants and stuff. Sherman marches through Georgia. If we're going to fight, because it's no longer the aristocrats who are fighting and us peons who really don't have a stake in their battles. Right? In fact, we would prefer that they don't fight. In fact, we're willing to accept lower incomes, lower, worse standards of living, reduced circumstances, if that will keep them on the same page. There's a great, the Peace of God movement in the 11th century, where the church cuts a deal with the nobles and says, look, we'll legitimate your reign of terror as long as you promise not to prey on the poor and us, the churches. This is after the Norwegians have come and pillaged Western Europe, by the way. That when our societies fight, everybody goes to war. If you're a German or Japanese, if you're Japanese in World War II, you live in the United States, we put you in a camp. Because we are all part of this society. So our societies are incredibly dangerous when they decide to fight. You do not want to mess with the U.S. Because if we need to, we'll send our children and our guns and we will kick your ass. And we will decide, even if we don't think it's legitimate, even if we think, many of us have reservations about what our leaders have done, boy, when we go to war, we go to war. And the reason is, these rules matter, right? The unity of our system matters in a way that medieval Europe just didn't have anything like that. So we're dangerous. But on a day-to-day basis, much less violent. And I'll talk about that, why that is.
I would just say, relative to what Amber was saying, is that there was a guy teaching last summer who had worked with the World Bank, And the issue was whether the World Bank should lend money to despots or not. Mm-hmm. And basically their view was the first thing that you have to have, more than anything, is you have to have order. Mm-hmm. You know, you have two guys that are in competition or two parties in mm-hmm. competition with each other. Until you have order first, then you can have that. Then you can actually start to progress. And mm-hmm. I think along the lines of that, there also was, I don't know if you've read, you probably read Jared Diamond's book, mm-hmm. The Guns Journey. I don't know how good his scholarship is, but he was quoting a study saying that even with war included, you're still less likely to die violently if another person now than you are, you know, than
before
the primitive.
Yes. I was probably the guy last summer who was talking about that.
Yeah. And you were? No.
I'm sure I was here last summer and I was talking about that. And I do work for the World Bank, but I consult with the World Bank.
But the other thing is that I think is interesting. I was studying the history of Polynesia, mm-hmm. and you would think here these people are just, you know, fish in the lagoon, coconuts on the trees. And I think it's the relationship between resources and violence also, which is there. I think they gave I think it was Easter Island was an example, you know, where you had the population had been very, very large, very, you know, more or less peaceful and orderly until the resources ran out because the population expanded. And when it was discovered by the West, there was sort of two groups of people at one end of each island, you know, very, very much fewer people and fighting with each other all the time. So.
Yeah. Okay, so I think Jared Diamond's great. And I highly recommend The Third Chimpanzee, which is the book you wrote before Guns, Germs, and Steel. And I highly recommend the first two-thirds of Guns, Germs, and Steel. And then I had to put it down. And I don't know Jared Diamond, but Jared Diamond's really good about how people act. Okay, and he's a polymath. He was an ornithologist. He was a physiologist. He's a professor at UCLA in the medical school. He's an incredibly integrative and talented guy. But he has a very simple view about how societies work. And he has this thing of, let's analogize from a person to a society. When does society lose the will to blank? So the Easter Island Society, when does society collapse? Now, resource constraints are always part of human societies. Okay? If you think about hunting and gathering technology and the resources on the world, they're much more constrained than we are. Resource depletion notwithstanding, we do a much better job of using our resources than hunters and gatherers do. Okay. We have cut down half the forest, but hunters and gatherers were great at devastating large areas as well. Animals are. We always change our environment. So the question is not if our resources there. Resources are always there. They're always part of the story. And there are always droughts, there are always floods, there's always all this kind of stuff. And so if you look at why a particular collapse occurred, right, there's going to be causal factors. There's going to be things that happen in that narrow time. But this is why I got those cold, hard facts. How long have humans been around before we got large societies? Millions of years, right? And so, and during those millions of years, resource constraint, you know, tides, floods, new crops, plants, all that kind of jazz occurred. And that's kind of like the no genetic change argument. And so there is a problem with saying societies collapse because of lack of resources. There are shocks at times which mean there's a bad crop and societies fall apart. There's the Black Death in Europe in the 14th century where the third of the population is killed within a couple of decades. There are definitely resources and things that are going on, but you have a real, if you're me and trying to do economic history over a long haul, you have an incredibly difficult time about making those arguments stick. Because successful societies are ones that manage to deal with these problems in a way that other societies haven't. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah, and so you want to think about this as a dynamic process. Right. And what happens 200 years ago is that the dynamics of the societies change completely.
Yeah, so, for example, living in cities. Because right? Now, people in cities now live longer than people in cities.
Right, oh yeah, now there's
completely different. Middle ages, they didn't.
Oh no, yeah, cities were really unhealthy until about 1900.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a strange thing, but I mean, I don't know how long ago, but was Obama was visiting with Chavez?
Mm-hmm.
What was the big deal about that? The relationships and the rules and all that. Doesn't that kind of tie into that little meeting he had with him and it made everybody mad? It made a lot of people mad, didn't it? That he was...
Yeah.
threatening him? I mean, I wondered what he thought.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know anything about politics. I just...
I don't have an explanation for that. On the
board. I mean, just briefly, just like, what is it, Reader's Digest version? Did he really violate some boundaries and do something horrible, or is he, you know?
Okay, so here's the deal.
Can he do that?
I don't know if I have this right or not. This is my naive interpretation of politics. Because I don't study modern, current politics. In fact, I don't study politics, really. I study constitutions and long-term institutional change. I do a lot of that. What's happened recently is we have, in a whole village, you can say Republicans. You know, some people get upset, but most people are like, yeah, those guys are really bad. I don't know. Lots of Lutherans used to be Republicans. My grandfather was a Lutheran. He was a Republican. So I don't want to get in Democrats being right or wrong. But the last 30 years, of Republican ascendancy has been one in which the moral position of not dealing with certain people from foreign countries has gained a sort of foreign policy appeal. So when Obama said, we're going to talk to Iran, right?
Well, Chavez, where's he from?
Venezuela.
Okay.
He's a populist. He is a potentially very...
dangerous? Or?
Yeah. Or it depends on how you think of it.
Barbaric?
Right?
Now, or is
there's people at home, there may be people here in the room who think Chavez is a hero.
Right.
Okay? So Chavez...
I don't know either.
Yeah, well, what happened was when Chavez took over in Venezuela, he's a former corporal or colonel, or and I don't know the details about.
Is he violent or something? Or?
Yeah, he is violent.
He promotes violence?
No, he says I'm for the people. So he nationalized the Venezuelan oil companies, and his model is Fidel Castro. Okay, so he's part of a group of leaders in Latin America who are populists, who are using, they're maintaining control of democracy because they're in fact buying. You know, all the words are loaded. Buying votes by delivering services to poor people.
Or helping poor people.
Right.
Exploiting.
Yeah, no, right. There's all kinds of things here that are really, really up in dispute about what he's doing.
Yeah.
What do we call this in America? Huey Long in the 1930s. Right? Was in Louisiana. Or Townsend, who had the, what was the name of the plan? We're going to give every person over 65 in America $200 a month.
The Townsend plan.
Yeah, that was a Townsend plan. And every man a king, Huey Long. Sometimes we call them demagogues, right? Now look, in democracy, this is very complicated because giving people stuff to buy their votes is what the Democratic and Republican Party are all about. It's what our system is all about, right? What? Senator Byrd in West Virginia, right? So I want Congress to be unbiased and impartial, and I want them to give me what I want. Okay. So Chavez is a Democrat in a populist country. He's a populist, and he has done things in America that would be completely illegal. And in Venezuela, may or may not be legal. I had a graduate student who came to Maryland. He's from Venezuela. His father owns a business in Venezuela. He was 2 years in graduate school at Maryland and didn't pass the comprehensive exams to go on for his PhD. So he had to leave, and he was applying to other graduate schools. And this was at the time there was a referendum on Chavez, and there was a petition to call a referendum, and his parents signed the petition. And he was getting money from Venezuela to come to graduate school, and guess what happened to that money? And he said, I'm really reluctant to go back. I want to go back to Venezuela to be with my parents. I'm reluctant to go back because I'm not sure what's going to happen. Because his parents were clearly part of the opposition to Chavez. And they are clearly worried about violence. And it is part of life in Latin America. Latin America is a more violent place. Both on the state and the non-state side. So when Obama went to talk to Chavez, there was a position which said, our leader should not talk to those evil leaders. Right? Obama, when he said, I'm going to open a dialogue with Iran, there was a bunch of neocons in the Republican Party who just went crazy that we should do that. But that has nothing to do with this.
I got a question.
Yeah.
How do, if listening to what we've talked about for the last couple of days, if the relationships are based on those feelings and those emotions, trust being a prominent one.
Yeah.
If Don and John, I don't feel trust. So how long can that relationship last? Because maybe it's just a personal way of life, but if I don't feel it good, it's not going to last long. And I don't see that Don and John's feels good enough to last very long. Does it?
Okay, that's a really, really, really good question. And this is why I wanted to talk the last 2 days about how people work, right? And to say that the Don John world is really one based on relationships. But if we want to think about relationships that feel good, right, they're the relationships that dominate a 30-person society. Okay, they're relationships where we have a personal contact and we understand. So trust can come about. There's a huge literature now on trust, the social capital that the human sexuality statement talks about. Continually came up in the overhead on Monday night about how we need to build social capital, how we have the common good, how if we believe that the social order that we live in is legitimate and fair, we are all tremendously better off, not just because we're more comfortable as individuals, but because we interact with one another in a different way. And that comfortness, right, you're not feeling with Don and John here, because one way is to trust is that we believe that other people have our interests at heart. That's the social trust. We want to believe that collectively, we as individuals have each other's interests. So you can trust me as a member of Fold, I'll watch your kids. Right? And if your kids are doing something, I'll grab them by the scruff of the neck and say, don't do that. And I'll trust both that I'll do that because I don't want the kid to be hurt, and then you're going to get mad at me because I touched your child or got mad at him. And if I think you are, I'm not going to do it. Right? But another way to trust people is I trust that you will act in my interest because it's in your interest to do so. That's a Don John. We do not think, most of us, that our elected representatives have my interest at heart, but it's in their interest to promote my interests. And we really think that that's why democracy works. Now, we like to elect good people, but we know sometimes we elect really slimy jerks. And anybody, as known a politician who's gotten elected to national office or anything, they are really ambitious people. They have to be. Okay. No matter how good they are, no matter how personal they are driven to do this. I don't trust any of them, no matter how good they are, because I don't trust the notion of social good. There's a definition of what it is that's going to change. Remember, we were here on Monday, at your session on Monday night, which is, so this issue of gay, lesbian rosters in the church, and the bound consciousness, that there are people who genuinely believe in the church that the other people are wrong, and vice versa, and how do we get it? And a woman said, if we were talking about race or slavery, these wouldn't come up. And I wish Mel was in the room, because Mel studies early 19th century intellectual history in America. And I said, let's talk about the Lutherans in 1840, when slavery was legal. You can bet there's a lot of bound consciousness about that decision. Do I want somebody saying, here's what the social good is, and here's how we should do it? No. I don't trust anybody who believes they know what's right for me.
But is that not, going back to his question, then, is that not where the fall occurred?
Yeah.
Because we didn't trust when God said the one rule, do not.
Yeah.
And we didn't trust.
Yeah.
It didn't feel good.
That's absolutely right.
We ate the apple.
But you know what? I don't live in that world. They don't pay me to talk to you about that. I mean this in the deepest and sincerest kind of way. We do not want a society without people like me. Okay? That's the Middle Ages. We need to understand how our society works. And if our understanding is different than the myths we have about how we talk to ourselves about, then, damn, we better change those myths. We better find out how society actually works. Because if we want to help poor people, we don't help poor people by giving them money. We teach them how to fish. But we do it even better if we put them in a society that works well. Well, I'm getting on to my Friday. Yeah, why Christians must think.
Or we value the conversation between the different ways of seeing it.
Yes, we do.
I mean, I think the myths can be different, and economics can be different, and we say we've got a conversation.
That's
we
right.
We need to maintain the balance.
That's right. No, and I agree that we need to do that, and I hope that I'm acting on that rather than just saying it. Right?
Yes.
When you come to Holden, part of the commitment of coming here is listening to people, whether you think they're right or wrong, and talking to them. Now, I'm not very calm, so I don't just You know, I get excited about the ideas, but we got to have this conversation. And we have to have a conversation if we really want to solve the problem of poverty. Those million people who died in Cambodia died because of the structure of their society. And it went off the rails. And most societies are set up so they periodically go off the rails. It's a real fear, and people are willing to give Don and John lots of resources to keep the society from going off the rails. They just, you know, now that puts too much rationality into the system, right? But we need to understand the logic of how the pieces interact in a way that's consistent with the way actual people behave. We need to come in and say, oh, everybody's rational. There's no emotions. There's no ideals. That would be dumb. So I'm trying not to do that. And in fact, I think, one more thing, I think that we all feel better about our society in the United States than people do in Mexico. Why? Because what we have resonates with the way we're wired in the 30-person society. On Monday, I asked you, which word did you prefer, equality or impersonality? And nobody said impersonality. Right? Everybody said equality. But I'm hoping I'm halfway towards you guys seeing that if everybody gets to form an organization, the dynamics of the society are completely different. If everybody's treated the same, this Don John world operates in a completely different way. So that's where we're going. Okay.
This is the first time I've been to one of your sessions, and I'll be here tomorrow to hear more. But I don't think you're saying, even though this has been going on for a very long time, that it's the ultimate.
No, I'm not Marxist. I don't believe that capitalism was inevitable. I don't believe the world we live in is the pinnacle of human experience.
Yeah.
I don't think we know what's going to happen next. I think there's only been 25 developed societies in human history. That's too small a sample to understand how they even work. In fact, if you read Adam Smith and you read Marx and Engels and you read a lot of 19th century intellectual history, what they were writing back then, they were all trying to understand what was happening to the world when the Don John part of it began to go away. Okay? So in America, religion is very much a part of this. Okay? The Protestant Reformation is important, maybe because Protestants are more individualistic and blah, 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 but it's really important because in societies like in New York, New York had freedom of conscience in the colonial period, but guess which churches could get a charter of incorporation, which meant they could borrow money to build their sanctuary? No, within the Protestants, because the Catholics were persona non grata in New York in the colonial period. Anglican and Dutch Reformed. Oh, the Church of England and the Church of the people that actually settled the place. Okay? So the first thing that the New York legislature did in 1783, the first post-revolutionary legislature, was to create what was called a General Incorporation Act for churches. Anybody who wanted to could get a charter from the state of New York and become a corporate entity as a church, which meant that they could borrow money as an entity, not as a partnership. In a partnership, when you borrow money, every partner is fully liable for the entire debt. Would you want to be in a church that borrowed money as a partnership to build a sanctuary? And where you might be on the hook, just like Rio Tinto? Right? No, you wouldn't. It's interesting, in Virginia, churches don't incorporate their trusts, so they have a completely different law. But until you make those organizational tools available to everybody, religious freedom is not quite the religious freedom that we experience. Because the state will say, England said in the 17th century, the state religion is Protestantism. Catholics cannot be king, Catholics not. They had a revolution, they cut off a king's head, right? They deposed another one, partly about religion. But if you weren't the right kind of Protestant, you didn't get the same privileges. Because there was one church, the Anglican Church, headed by the king. Episcopalians still have trouble. There's good reasons for Lutherans to have worries about the Episcopalians. They still pray for the Archbishop of Canterbury. Right? And they have a society with a group that has access to organizational tools that the rest of the society didn't. That's a Don John. That's a limited access society.
Kind of coming down out of the clouds and all the same concept, the micro loan movement, microfinance, is, as I understand a little bit from reading Eunice himself, he tells a pretty good story. That
the reading who?
Muhammad Eunice.
Okay, right. The guy who started the Grameen Bank.
Yeah. It's an economic theory. How does that connect with the overall? That's an example of. Is it good? Has it got any validity?
This is like talking about Venezuela now. So,
yeah.
Yes and no. It's not a cure-all. Okay. And what you're really talking about is society structuring an organization in a particular kind of way. Okay, so in India, the Grameen Bank, who this guy starts, makes loans to people, small loans to people in groups. The interest rates on those loans are often over 50% a year. They're extremely high interest rates. And in fact, when you borrow the money from the bank, you get a group of people together, and they're all jointly liable for your, right? So you pay back because otherwise they'll beat you up or, you know, shun you or something. So it's a way to get capital into these societies that don't have it. There's the more visible person's name is Hernando de Soto. He's kind of an economist from Peru. His brother was the president of Peru, who was the one that finally dealt with the Shining Path revolutionary movement. And De Soto says, you know, what we need is secure property rights and land so people can borrow money on the security of the land that they own. All these things I think are okay, but they're not world changers. I mean, okay. Oh, this is a teaching moment. Societies are relationships supported by rules, right? They aren't rules where their relationships happen. Our societies are not. If you try to describe the society and you write down, if you read the U.S. Constitution, does that describe American society? No, it's a skeleton. Right? It's just the nub of the little piece. The relationship goes on outside of the rules. This is a case in which you can change a rule and you actually make this organization feasible. And what happens is, in many developing countries, these are ways for them to attract money from outside. Right? So some of these things, I don't want to say they're shams, they're not, but they're also ways for their owners to make money by borrowing money, essentially by Lutherans in America giving them money for free that they're lending to Indians for 50% a year. That's a great profit opportunity. Okay. Now, hopefully that money will stay in the bank, but it's a change in the rule that enables the relationship between the borrower and the lender in these communities to have a default option. So what happens when the guy doesn't pay back the loan? When you got really poor people who don't have any collateral, who don't have any assets, you know they're not going to pay back the loan, so you don't make the loan in the first place. Or if you make the loan, it's got to be at 50%, because 2 in 10 people are going to default. So if you're going to make an average rate of return, you got to get a really high interest on the loans that you do make, which is why credit card companies charge 18% to college students, because many college students don't pay the loan back. I have a colleague who's currently, he's an expert testimony on credit cards. And the federal government is really wrestling now with this. You know, what interest rate should credit cards charge? If the federal government says to Visa, 5% is the maximum you can charge, will they loan to college students? No, they'll stop. Bam, they'll be done. Okay, so this is about what kind of rules are sustainable, right? What kind of rules are sustainable? If you came in with a Grameen Bank to Chelan, it wouldn't go anywhere, because there's lots of banks willing to loan you money at, you know, prime plus 2%. We borrowed 16% of the personal signature and established your relationship. It's a change in rules in developing countries that is making some relationships more sustainable. Okay, and so what you see when you go into these communities is not just it's not the market-based capital that's the only thing that's going on. It is, in fact, construction of social capital around a financial institution. So I want to tilt you guys. Societies are based on relationships. And rules exist not because they govern the relationships, but because they're the piece that happens when the relationships are incomplete and fall apart. We do not want the roster policy to dominate the placing of clergy and other employees within the church. We do not. But we also want to have the rules so we can do a good job of using our relationships and our personal information about people to put them in the right places. Okay. All right. Be back tomorrow. Jubilee.